Welcome back to Explore Cell Therapy, the podcast where we explore practice-changing research and hot topics in hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and other cellular therapies through conversations with transplant centers and hematology-oncology practices. I'm your host, Sam Waters, Research and Education Lead at the National Marrow Donor Program, NMDP Be the Match. And for this episode, I was joined by Dr. Karen Ballin of University of Virginia Health and Dr. Mutul Gandhi of Virginia Cancer Specialists to discuss current research into barriers, referral patterns, and other issues that lead to differential access to care. We also explore ways to overcome these barriers and how coordinated care or shared care between transplant centers and hematology-oncology practices can help. To read bios on our guests and access additional resources related to today's episode, click the link in the episode description. This is part two of a two-part discussion. So speaking of sort of race and ethnicity issues in transplant, you know, we all know that health equity and health disparities are prominent in healthcare, and transplant's no different. Can you speak maybe a little bit to this issue in the context of transplant, sort of where those access issues tend to arise for these patients specifically, and what we can try to do potentially to help close some of those gaps?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So we do know that it is easier for patients of Northern European background, like English, Irish, German, to find donors, fully matched donors in the Be the Match registry. And it is harder for African Americans too. But as I mentioned at the beginning, I think now with modern techniques of mismatched family members, we're doing a trial now on mismatched unrelated donors, appropriately called ACCESS, that we are able to find donors for most people, regardless of their racial and ethnic ancestry. But sometimes it could take a little bit longer. And so this is where getting started early in the process can help out. I think that we need to put more resources into communities at risk, which could be communities with a high percentage of Black patients. As I mentioned, there are other factors that we've identified at risk, educational level, socioeconomic status, to really increase education and put more resources outside of just an insurance company paying for the transplant itself. And so what could that look like? Transportation is huge, especially today with the price of gas. And this is a real issue for people after they've gone home after transplant and they need to come back and forth for visits, that it's a huge financial issue, assuming that they have two cars and they can take the time off from work. So, you know, we are a state institution and we're able to provide help with gas cards and grocery cards and sometimes housing, depending on the patient's financial status for when they are here. But I think more programs like that, I know the Be the Match also offers funding for patients. And Medicaid sometimes pays for transportation. But for instance, you know, yesterday I had two patients who were supposed to get a ride with Medicaid and the car never showed up. And you know, that's it. You know, now they have to wait another 3 days because you need 3 days to schedule the car ride and, you know, stuff happens and they had already planned to take the time off from work. And, you know, so I think we need to think about a lot better, supports outside of just, yes, insurance will cover, you know, you being in the hospital for 4 weeks or cover some of your prescription drugs. So I think we need to look at the whole package of healthcare would involve maybe payment for caregiver support, transportation, payment for time off from work or a more flexible leave policy so that patients can really get the whole package of care. And honestly, I think in the long run, that will save people and taxpayers money, because if you can take care of patients in their community, keep them out of the hospital, you know, that there's obviously saving of resources that way.
Yeah, and I, you know, to that point, there's this temptation to group a lot of discrete elements of oncology together and, you know, under this broad umbrella of cancer patient. And not to pick out one disease versus another, but there are plenty where you have finite courses of chemotherapy with a somewhat intense short-term toxicity and then pretty rapid convalescence to reconstitution and normal way of life. These bone marrow disorders are not that. The treatment paradigms are much, much longer, often stretching out well over 12 months, and then a lot of the after effects even beyond that. And so it's a toll to kind of think about what the ramifications are going to be to your family and your finances for a year, 2 years, 3 years out. You can very rapidly deplete your savings just on transportation. And we've seen that. And so having a policy structure that kind of intelligently anticipates these sort of demands on a patient and family probably would help kind of get just ease in terms of access. I think that part is critical.
And I think there's two other things that that we could consider that are really like in our, you know, changing the whole medical structure in the U.S. might be tough in this hour, but hey, we can try. You know, so one is this a program from Be the Match called HLA Today, which allows patients to be HLA typed in their community, which is just a cheek swab, completely free, no charge to their insurance. And then that is a help. One thing I think is just important to know that that's just the first step. So that typing comes back to the oncologist that, you know, signs the paperwork. It doesn't actually come to a transplant center unless you specifically request it or send it to us. And of course, it can go to as many transplant centers as you want if patients are, you know, still considering, you know, which transplant center they want. Obviously, where you live, Matul, patients have a lot of choices. That's, you know, not true, in, of course, in all areas of the country. So that, I think, just saves some time. It doesn't help with transportation, any of the financial issues, but just saves some time in terms of finding donors and allows the transplant center to get a head start on the typing and finding donors. The second thing is, you know, transplant is very heavily regulated by our FACT, Federation for Accreditation of Cell Therapy. And the goal of that is to increase quality in transplant, which of course is important to make sure that everyone who's caring for transplant patients are appropriately trained and keep up to date on their education. And but I think it also limits a little bit of what can be done outside of the transplant center and in the community. And I'd love to see FACT maybe take a new line on it where it's not just everything that happens at the transplant centers, but, you know, partnering with community providers and allowing a little bit more of the care to be done in the community without, let's say, your practice, Matul, having to undergo a FACT inspection, because, you know, that's a huge deal that you wouldn't want to do, but maybe certifying, you know, a few aspects of it, or in some way allowing us to provide more transplant care outside the transplant center. I'm not exactly sure how that would work, but I think there could be ways to improve that that would allow more care in the community. And then community providers maybe that aren't as familiar with transplant, you know, that's how they learn with, you know, our help. And then you don't have as much travel and other issues. And a lot really could be done with telehealth now, which, you know, we've learned from the pandemic that can be done, and we need maybe a better structure to figure out, you know, how to do that, and so that patients could get more of their post-transplant care closer to home.
Yeah, I mean, you know, not to get into the granularity of FACT accreditation, that's probably not the point, but I think, you know, to your point, a phoresis of, you know, cellular products, and then that can be kept and then frozen and then shipped, that saves, you know, a week oftentimes for a patient. And you amplify that, there's a lot of savings. So fully agree with that, particularly as sort of the next generation of cellular therapy kind of really starts taking shape. You know, we see it obviously in the lymphoid malignancies, but increasingly in myeloid malignancies as well. There's probably going to have to be a somewhat of a paradigm shift to allow latitude of places of who have comfort level doing it, offload, you know, these really backed up university centers, and then also facilitate, you know, a wider footprint to getting these cures. I 100% agree with that. You know, one of the things that this was probably a few minutes ago that I was thinking about, as you're thinking about minority communities, there is a few, I'm this happened to me, Karen, actually, is I think seeing this patient or transplanting her actively, a patient that I saw that had a abnormal CBC was rushed in to see me, rushed in, but almost 6, 8 weeks later, and we discovered AML that day and promptly admitted her. One of the things that we found, and I think the data has borne this out, and I can't speak to all the transplant data, it's not just the ethnicity as it pertains to their support system, it's the comorbidities that they come in with more often than not, and there's clear biologic differences in that disease beyond some of the molecular and genetic stratification that we all kind of get out. And these are kind of more things to you're trying to educate on something already complex. When that happens, you're also introducing often language barriers that we run into. And so explaining AML, ALL is hard enough when we're speaking in English, but you try to do that through a third party translator. There's as good as they are and as good as medical translation is. I often feel leaving a little unsatisfied that I haven't done a good enough job, kind of properly educating them on what they're going to get now and then why I have to send them elsewhere. The rare instances that I have patients who have a lot of the disease that I treat that speak languages that I grew up with, it you can immediately tell there is a cultural gap bridged almost instantaneously and a level of trust and rapport that makes all the some of the complex decisions that much easier. And it speaks to, you know, our physician population doesn't necessarily reflect our patient population. And we're not going to solve those problems, but these are the other kind of cultural barriers that you are working around in kind of establishing trust rapport and why they have to go to see Dr. Ballen 80 miles away.
Right. No, that's a really good point. And speaking about that sort of provider trust, do you feel that, you know, the strength of your relationship or your working relationship kind of helps patients trust in the transplant process a little bit more, or makes them more willing to go that next step for a consult, especially when it is so far away?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very upfront with patients and transparent about what they have. If anyone wants a second opinion, third opinion, fourth, you need to get it. You need to find what relationship works right for you because this is their life and you have the agency to figure out where you want to put your trust in. I mean, that's tantamount to what we do. Sometimes I don't have the luxury of saying you've got time to, you know, get a few opinions in the next month because that's not feasible with their kind of status. But that's the ultimate currency in what we do, is having faith and trust. And it's bi-directional. You know, I think candidly, we refer to people that we trust as physicians. You know, you want to be able to send your patient to someone that you would send your family member to. That said a lot, but there's a lot of truth to that. You want to be able to provide and have them get care that you would want for anyone else. So, you know, I think when Karen sees them, I imagine it's similar. I'll let her speak to that. But for us, it's, you know, we're very honest. We offer if they want to pursue care elsewhere. We recognize that some people say they have to go to Center X, and we support that. But then we leverage sort of that relationship that we built with our partner physicians at, you know, places like UVA to make sure that they know we're sending them to places we trust.
I think the trust is really important in healthcare in general. And of course, patients today, you know, they, Dr. Google, and they have lots of access to information. Some of which is very good and some, you know, not so good. I think, you know, it's a little bit easier for me when I see the patient. They've already learned about the diagnosis, have had some time to digest it. Most of the time they've had some chemotherapy and kind of have a sense of what that's like and how that makes them feel and what it's like to interact with the healthcare system. So in some sense, it's a lot easier when they, you know, come to see me because I'm usually not the one that's told them their diagnosis and sat down and had those kind of tough initial conversations. But I think the trust aspect and patient feeling comfortable is really key. You know, a lot of our patients live in areas where they have the choice of many transplant centers. And just like Matul said, I always encourage people want to talk to another transplant center to do that. The last thing you want to do is, you know, take someone to transplant who doesn't feel comfortable with your center. That's not, you know, a paradigm for success. And so, you know, I think that is important that patients and their insurance companies give them the ability to, you know, maybe talk to a couple of different specialists if that's what they want. And sometimes just hearing it from two different centers or two different groups, you know, makes the patient feel comfortable, and then they feel comfortable with whatever decision they have to make. You know, there's so many different decision points in oncology and transplant that that sometimes you can't anticipate at the beginning. And so having that trust relationship and sometimes even being able to say to the patient, you know, hey, I'm not sure what this is, but it could be X, Y, or Z. And I think we should do this test, but I'm going to talk to this specialist first, or I'm going to talk to someone else, you know, at another center. Or I think that sometimes really helps the patient feel more comfortable with the care that they're getting.
For sure. So thinking a little bit about, you know, we've been speaking about sort of the role of transplant and community hematology oncology physicians in kind of helping overcome these barriers, and obviously talking about some policy changes that could really help as well. But I'm curious, thinking about this concept of the expanded care team, who else do you feel are those major players in this process that have a role to play in helping overcome these barriers and sparking change?
I think, you know, from the local level, we've got very dynamic and highly intelligent nurse navigators that are instrumental in care delivery, probably the backbone of care delivery, I would say, that orchestrate a lot of the nuances and details to make sure there is this sort of overarching timeline of where people need to be and need to go and why things need to be done. And they've got their own infrastructure underneath them between patient care coordinators, social work support. We're fortunate enough to have a large enough institution to have all of these elements ranging from palliative care, dietary, et cetera, et cetera. And even though, you know, I make medical decisions while I'm, you know, doing my notes at 10 p.m. at night or something along those lines. Someone has to execute that and make it actually come to fruition. And, you know, we're reliant on this sort of large apparatus to do that. One of the things that I think has helped, and this is one particular element that I hope we can mature out that might help kind of address some of the barriers that we've discussed, is having the nurse navigator at the transplant center be in easy communication with the local nurse navigator. And that quite honestly, not just solves problems, it prevents problems from ever occurring. And that element of care delivery, we probably are spending more time on now at our practice, and I think more largely in oncology in general. And the results have been, you know, nothing short of just miraculous.
Yeah, I'd like to second that point. I mean, you know, the care is given a lot, you know, by nurses and all the other members of the healthcare team, dietary, physical therapy, like Matul mentioned, social work, and other medical specialists, palliative care, infectious disease, you know, pathology that patients never see, or the radiologist that reads their x-rays. And I always tell patients that actually the people that you don't see are the ones that sometimes are the most important for your care. So I do think some sort of integrated model. And of course, you know, we're all aware of the nursing shortage and other healthcare providers. And I think having a, you know, some really recognizing the role that all these other healthcare providers play in the patient's care, you know, I think is really key. Oncology nursing is a tough field. So I think it's very dedicated professionals that, you know, choose to go in it and stay in it for many years.
Yeah, and I agree. Some days it can be a thankless endeavor because of the mountain of work, complexity of care involved, and trying to coordinate a lot. One of the things that, you know, I think we've appreciated is, you know, Karen is always supremely responsive to anytime I email her. And she and I exchange emails, unfortunately, late at night. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but it occurs. But that is just so integral in making sure, even when the patient is discharged from the transplant practice and is back in our world, that there is ability to attend to all these things that can happen. But the second parallel to that is our mid-level providers and nursing support are also responsive to kind of questions that may come up or issues that we may have. And one of the things that's helped, you know, this sort of geographic issue, financial issue, is trying to get a lot of this logjam of pre-transplant workup that can be done locally at centers that you trust and, you know, sort of providers that you believe in. That helps so that, you know, the patient does not have to go to Charlottesville for things like echocardiograms, bone scans, or whatever else may be needed in order to ensure that all the checklists are done to safely go forth with the transplant. If we can get it done locally and then seamlessly have that data kind of transmitted, that goes a long way. And then for the patient, it just means that many more days at home and that many more less days of travel. So that sort of physician level engagement, you know, I know we're targeting physicians. I think that's step one. You have to be able to have a really good, hopefully working relationship with whoever you're going to be sending your patients to. But then immediately 1A is making sure that ancillary coordination is just as seamless. And patients notice this. They're not oblivious to this. They know very quickly whether a patient is a, you know, PhD or a high school grad. They have very savvy sense of knowing when there's coordinated care or not, and when balls are dropped or not. And appropriately kind of recognize that, you know, the onus is on my treatment team to, you know, take care of this. And we rightly demand that that coordination is done, you know, without us requesting it constantly.
Yeah, and in some sort of integrated healthcare system, you know, whether it's Epic or whatever, you know, the platform is, you know, that is helpful when other providers are on the same system. But, you know, I would say that that is rarely the case. And so that doesn't mean it can't happen. But, you know, I think that would be something moving forward as a healthcare system that might that might help.
No, I think that's a really, really great point. I would imagine that trying to maintain those relationships and keep up with communication between all your members of the care team when you're not working on the same system is very challenging. But I do think you're right. I think patients know and trust better in the process if they can see that coordination between the two of you and between the care team as a whole. I know that shared care and coordinated care is something that is a real focus of NMDP as well. And we've been working with actually Dana-Farber on some shared care recommendations that we hope to push out nationally. So hopefully we can help be part of the solution as well, as you guys are working very hard on this too. So thinking a little bit, you know, about sort of the looking down the road at the future, I'd like to kind of close this with sort of a comment or a question about the one biggest change or reform that each of you personally would like to see implemented in the next few years to help overcome these barriers. Because we've been throwing out a lot of ideas and potential solutions. But I'd love to hear from each of you sort of like, what's that one major thing that you would like to see implemented to help overcome some of these barriers and access issues? And how can we sort of make this process more inclusive and a smoother path to transplant for patients?
That's hard to find one thing. I'll say this, I'm not by any stretch a health policy expert, and I do not know, I can't speak to the granularity of the nuances of government versus private payer issues covering certain elements. But I think Karen's initial point was the right one, is that this has to be looked as a continuum of care with sufficient allocation of resources to allow that. And it cannot be, we're going to pay X amount for the actual transplant, and then everything else falls by the wayside, because that's a sort of a myopic way to view what this process actually is. And so having a policy that's articulated around the sort of longitudinal care and making sure resources are made available to address things like transportation, like family leave, like child care, and I don't, that's not easy, whether it's in this political climate or the future one. It's there's a lot of kind of various stakeholders that have very different interpretations of what, you know, that model should be and how to deliver it. But for someone who sees these malignancies and hears about what can and can't be done directly from my patients and their family members, I think that immediately to me is a thing that jumps out, because it's pretty disheartening to hear that, my daughter would like to help, but, you know, who's going to take care of her kids, or she can't get out of work, or, you know, we have one car, gas is $5 a gallon, et cetera, et cetera. And having something that appropriately addresses that is the sort of most immediate thing in my mind. If you resolve that, the rest of it is on me, right? Is making sure that am I providing state-of-the-art care or not before I send them to Dr. Ballen? Are we establishing a relationship of trust so that they know what we are doing is in line with what would be done anywhere else, and we're sending them to the right places? And that's fine, because that's something that lands on my shoulders, and that onus and responsibility is on us.
Okay, I have three. Okay, so I think the first, I would just echo what Mitul said, a different system of healthcare payments that allows for non-crisis catastrophic care that pays for transportation, time off from work. Recognizing the long continuity of care that it takes after transplant, and, you know, and often in other, you know, hem-onc diseases as well. So I think that would be the first one. The second is, I think, some more liberal fact accreditation that would allow community sites to do some of the things that Mitul mentioned, like apheresis, which they may be doing anyway for patients with Guillain-Barré, and they may have like a perfectly beautiful, fully equipped apheresis center, but unless they're fact accredited, they can't be used for transplant. So, you know, and I think that's actually the case for your group, right? So I think, you know, things like that, that still maintain the quality, but are a little bit less rigid, which is costly. The rigidity is costly. So that's second. And the third thing, and this I'll send back to Be the Match. I would love to see an MDP and Be the Match with their resources actually help with caregiving, provide caregiving for people that don't have a caregiver. That is a big reason why people can't get to transplant. Or, you know, maybe they have a caregiver for a week or two, but not a month or two, or their caregiver needs to work part-time or something. It could even be a caregiver, could be for a couple of transplant patients in a hotel, you know, to reduce cost, and they all go to the, you know, hospital together for their visits, and someone checks in with them, you know, and so I think some way that NMDP Be the Match can also, which provides a lot of resources for patients, could consider providing caregiving. And I know it's something that I've talked to Dr. Devine about, and I think is I'm sure on a long list of asks. But. And I guess just to end on a positive note, I do think, although we obviously have a lot of challenges and things we need to work on, I think we've made a lot of progress. First of all, just in cancer care as a whole, but particularly in transplant, in donor selection, in treatment and prevention of graft versus host disease, and maybe a recognition now of some of these other aspects of access to care and healthcare disparities that we haven't solved, but at least we are starting to recognize and talk about them.
I echo that last component. You know, I think for whether you're a doctor or really an oncologist out, you know, 200 miles away from a transplant center or not, I think the these people are able to be helped and oftentimes saved to a productive, long, sort of lasting life. It's possible. And I think, and we're seeing that so much more frequently. So it's work, but it's worth it.
No, absolutely. I think that's a wonderful note to end on. And, you know, being an NMDP employee, I know we're all, you know, we're here for the same reason. And that's, you know, at the end of the day, we want to do what's best for patients and help patients in any way we can. So I really appreciate the insight into sort of future directions for us as well, because I think that's really valuable. We've tried very hard to, as you know, so this podcast is a great example of a way we're trying to promote shared and coordinated care and understanding and continuing education among providers. But, you know, we obviously do a lot of patient education and patient support services as well. But yeah, there's so much more we could be doing and farther that I think we all could be going. And, you know, these conversations hopefully will help us, you know, help us get there. So I think that's wonderful. Well, thank you both so much for your time. This has been a great discussion and really thought-provoking. So I really appreciate it today.
Yeah, thank you for setting it up. Yeah, I enjoyed this. And thanks, as always, to Karen, who's just supremely professional and helpful for all our patients. It really is wonderful to work with her.
Well, thank you so much, Matul. We enjoy working with you and your colleagues as well. And thank you so much, Sam, for setting this up. This will be really fun. And definitely let it know when it comes out so I can tell my mother.
Absolutely, we will. Thanks again.
Thanks again for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this two-part episode series. For more information and access to resources and research referenced throughout the series, remember to click the link in the episode description. See you next time on Explore Cell Therapy.